Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Incumbent Democratic Governor Peter Shumlin kicked off his reelection campaign this week. Shumlin told his supporters that he plans to pursue the agenda that he's been working on for the last 4 years. That's the creation of good-paying jobs and working to have Vermont become the first state in the country to implement a single-payer health care system, perhaps as early as 2017. Now, Vermont's healthcare exchange, known as Vermont Health Connect, has had a lot of serious technical problems in its first year of operation, and Libertarian gubernatorial candidate Dan Feliciano says it was a big mistake for Vermont to set up its own exchange and make participation mandatory for all individuals and small businesses. He says this was done as the first step towards single payer.
The real answer to this question is to fulfill Peter Shumlin's fantasy of being the first governor to implement single-payer health care. The governor has disregarded the needs of Vermonters in his quest. There is a better way. We can provide affordable health care choices to Vermonters, but the government needs to get out of the way.
Should the problems at Vermont Health Connect be a signal that moving to single-payer might not be such a good idea? Or do these problems show why Vermont should implement a single-payer system? And how will single payer be paid for? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Governor Peter Shumlin. Governor, thanks for being on the program.
Hey, it's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. We're going to talk about health care. We're going to talk about the economy. What are the issues on your mind, the big issues facing the state of Vermont in this campaign year? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better yet, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So let's start off with this notion that Dan Feliciano has, that Vermont should drop having its own health care exchange and join the federal exchange. Could save the state a lot of money, a lot of heartache, a lot of technical problems. Is it a good idea?
No, it isn't. And I can tell you why we didn't. And it's, you know, this probably hasn't been spelled out well enough, and I take some blame for that. Vermont and Massachusetts are the only two states in America who, before the Affordable Care Act was passed, subsidized health care, helped lower-income people pay for health care at a higher rate than the federal bill. So the reason that Vermont chose to build its own exchange is that if we had gone with a federal exchange, we would have told thousands and thousands of Vermonters, you've got to go to the federal exchange, and the benefit is going to drop significantly. So if you look at the bipartisan work that was done by governors of both parties, Catamount under Governor Douglas, VHAP, Dr. Dinerst under Cunins and Dean, all that goes out the window. And we would have had to simply say, sorry, folks, it's going to cost you anywhere from $700 a year to $1,000 a year more to pay for health insurance that you're already struggling to pay for right now. Go to the federal exchange. You're on your own. See you later. So we had no choice. If we were going to continue to help Vermonters at the level that we were helping them before the Affordable Care Act, we had to do it through our own exchange or say goodbye to thousands and thousands of Vermonters. No help for you. You're stuck with the federal bill.
So Feliciano says that's not exactly the case. He said the state would save a lot of money by going to the federal exchange. Why not take that money and provide these people with state subsidies?
Well, then the question for Dan is, how would those subsidies work? And he's incorrect about that. The federal exchange, let's not forget, is being built by federal dollars. Whether we use federal dollars to build our own exchange or ask the federal government to use their money to go to their exchange, it didn't cost Vermont taxpayers money to build our own exchange.
So the idea that Vermont has a mandatory participation in the exchange, all individuals, all small businesses, and those are businesses with fewer than 50 employees, have to go through the exchange if they want to buy health insurance coverage. Now, we're starting to hear some Democratic leaders at the State House say, in light of all the problems at Vermont Health Connect, maybe we should rethink this mandatory piece and make it voluntary beginning in 2015. Would you support that?
Not only would I support it, I did. Let's talk about what actually happened. The mandatory quote-unquote exchange is not mandatory for most Vermonters. When we had challenges, and no one's more frustrated than I am with the challenge we've had at Vermont Health Connect, and frankly, I join every other governor in the country and the President of the United States in having challenges building our exchange. Having said that, As soon as we recognized that we had challenges, we turned to the people that we could, which is businesses, which is employers and employees, and said, hey, you don't have to go through the exchange. You can go through Blue Cross Blue Shield, VHAP. That's what they're – I mean, and that's what – not VHAP, but obviously the carriers that we're providing. And you can buy direct from your insurance company just as you always did. That's what they're doing right now. So therefore, I would argue that most Vermonters are not buying their health insurance in the exchange. So now the question is, why do we leave individuals in the exchange? And the answer is that under federal law, it is illegal for Blue Cross Blue Shield or MVP to have access to the income information that would require them to verify their incomes and get the subsidies to the majority of the folks in the exchange who get subsidies. So the folks in the exchange, the vast majority of Vermonters, are getting both federal and state help. The federal law does not allow them to have access to that income information.
What about all the people who have signed up for coverage on the exchange who are not eligible for subsidies? Those folks could buy directly from Blue Cross. Why don't you let them?
We talked to Blue Cross and MVP about that early on. They weren't particularly anxious to take that book of business. It's a small number of the overall people in the exchange, so it doesn't really solve a problem. Listen, I can tell you this. This is the most frustrating job that I've ever had to undertake, dealing with this healthcare exchange. Number one, no one is more disappointed than I am. No one's more frustrated. No one's had more sleepless nights. Having said that, if you think you've got a silver bullet that solves all our problems, I can almost assure you that it's more complicated than you think. And that's what's wrong with the Affordable Care Act. You know, this isn't my idea of healthcare reform. It does help some Vermonters. It helps a lot of people in states like Alabama and Mississippi who weren't getting any help before. But bottom line is, only Washington, D.C. could come up with a healthcare bill that keeps all the special interests happy, all the insurance companies happy, and takes an already too complex system and makes it more complicated. And that's what they've done.
So there are a number of people who think that this rocky rollout of Vermont Health Connect has undermined public confidence in moving to a single-payer system. And recently I posed this question to Lawrence Miller, who is your healthcare chief.
Do I agree that it's undermined support? Yes. I think given people's perspective today, they're clearly intimidated. I think we have to... in January, be prepared to lay out a clear operations plan that demonstrates why the statement I just made about it being simpler and lower risk is true.
People's confidence in single payer has been hurt severely by the tough performance of Vermont Health Connect.
Absolutely. You know, many Vermonters believe that the Affordable Care Act is single payer health care. And they couldn't be more different. So I think Lawrence hits it on the head. Our job is, first of all, to come up with a financing plan that we can believe in and that Vermonters can learn about. And secondly, go out and clearly explain to Vermonters in a very transparent and open conversation why our plan will be simpler, more inclusive, and better than anything anyone else is doing in America, including the Affordable Care Act. So yes, it's muddied the waters. It's made it more difficult, no question about it. But I was elected to get tough things done. Let's go to the big question. Why do I think this is so important? You know, governors have to manage, you know, the everyday crises that we face, and I do a lot of that. But we also have to be able to ensure that we're making the really bold decisions, the tough decisions that are going to put Vermont on better ground long after we're gone. And when I look at the challenges we're facing in the state, I see it this way. The biggest challenge we have is jobs, job creation, and prosperity, affordability. And we're making some real progress there. You know, as you know, we have among the lowest unemployment rates in the country. We've created 9,200 new jobs since I've been governor. That moves every month, but that's what it is this month. And we're doing better than the states around us. But that doesn't help you if you're a middle-class Vermonter who is still struggling, because they are, or if you're a low-income Vermonter who's in worse shape than you were before the recession. This is true nationally, and it's true in Vermont. The top 1% is doing great. Everybody else is continuing to limp in many cases. So when I get asked the question, what are the long-term things that are going to make a difference for Vermont in terms of affordability? Healthcare is gobbling up more money than our incomes, than faster than our incomes are rising at a rate not only in Vermont but America, where we're now spending huge amounts of money on healthcare, 20 cents on every dollar we make in Vermont, and that number doubles if we don't in the next 10 years if we don't change our behavior. So what I'm trying to do is really move to a system where everybody has health insurance because they're a Vermonter. No more questions about who you work for, Affordable Care Act, what your income levels are. Everyone's in because you're a resident of the state of Vermont. Second, where we pay for it by a system that is not premium driven, but based upon ability to pay. And third, where we spend the money more wisely for better outcomes, healthier outcomes, while cutting the cost, the otherwise unsustainable cost of healthcare. That's a huge project. But if we do that, it grows jobs. I mean, as Bill Clinton said the other day, and I agree with him, the reason we're fighting about a minimum wage in this country, the reason that people aren't seeing their incomes go up in the middle class, one of the main drivers is that healthcare is gobbling up money faster than employers can give raises. This is what's holding us back as a nation.
So you mentioned the financing plan. Now, when Act 48 was passed in 2011, it called on you to have a financing plan in January of 2013. At that time, you said, well, let's put it off for a year. So you waited until January of 2014. Then you said, hey, this is really complicated stuff. Let's wait until January of 2015. You know, there's some people who are wondering, you've had 3 years to come up with a financing plan. Where is it? Why haven't you been able to do it?
Because nobody's done it before. I would argue we've had over 200 years to get into the mess that we're in. And Vermont is one of the only states in the country that's trying to figure out a way to get out of it in a way that's going to be include everybody, not make healthcare an extraordinary burden, not make healthcare one of the biggest challenges that Vermonters face, and make it affordable. So, well, if we've learned anything from the Affordable Care Act, it's pretty simple. Don't go out with plans that are half-baked and not ready for prime time. So we're trying to get this right. It's, as I've mentioned, it's complicated. It's not easy. We've got a great team working on it. And we intend by January to have a plan for the legislature and Vermonters to look at and discuss. It's a very important conversation for Vermont to have. Listen, this is what I can assure you. We can pick on the timelines. You know that I thought that we could get this done by 2015 when I was elected. The Affordable Care Act precluded us under federal law, any state, from moving to a single-payer plan until 2017. So we had to change the time date. Therefore, we had more time to come up with a financing plan, and we took it. Having said that, we need to take it because this is hard work. But this is what I can assure you. I'm one of the most pro-business, anti-tax governors that you've seen in a long time. I've managed now 4 consecutive budgets tough budgets, balancing them without raising broad-based taxes. We've got one of the best bond ratings in the country. Some of my own party, you know, were yelling and screaming that they're mad at me because I won't raise income taxes, sales taxes, rooms and meals taxes, because I personally believe they're high enough for Vermont. They don't need to be higher. If we come up with a financing plan that doesn't grow jobs, economic opportunity, and make Vermont more prosperous, trust me, we're not going to do it. So if we all agree, and I bet there's pretty broad-based consensus in Vermont, that we've got to change the way we're doing healthcare or we're going to continue to have struggles with affordability, the beauty of Vermont is we can have a conversation like this, make the right decisions, and move forward. And that's the plan we're going to come up with.
But, you know, people will look at this and say, wait a minute now, Peter Shumlin's had 3 years to look at a financing plan. You're talking about releasing a plan in about 3 months. You must have some idea, just a general outline of how you would like this to work. So can you share that with us?
I want it to be based on ability to pay, and I don't want to lose federal dollars while we do it. So, you know, it's not simple, but we're coming up with a good plan that I think will be based on ability to pay. It would be a huge mistake, let the Affordable Care Act be testament to that, of going out with something that isn't ready. We're not there yet. We'll get there, but we're not there yet.
Let's go to our callers and start off with Damon, who is calling from Williston. Hey, Damon, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Governor Shumlin, in 2011, after the devastation of Irene, you said, and I quote, "We've got to get off of fossil fuels as quickly as we know how to make this planet livable for our children and grandchildren," end quote. Yet you support the Vermont gas pipeline, which will cost hundreds of millions of dollars to build. It'll seize Vermonters' land by eminent domain, and it'll cement in our state's reliance on fossil fuels for the next 70 years. So my question for you is, why have you changed your mind about getting the state off of fossil fuels as soon as possible in order to leave a livable planet for our children and grandchildren?
And let me just add something to Damon's question as well when you answer it. We've seen estimates now that the pipeline is going to cost 40% more than the original estimates, going back to the Public Service Board for its review because of that. And I'm also wondering, has that number, that 40% jump in the cost, has that caused you to reevaluate whether or not you want to support it?
Well, it's caused the board to reevaluate. The board's doing their job, and I'm glad that they're having a second look at it. That should be expected when a cost overrun of that nature happens. So I trust the Public Service Board to make the right decisions there, and obviously it's their job to look at that, and they will. But I want to go back to the premise of Damon's call. Damon, I am the governor, one of the governors in America, who believes that climate change is the biggest challenge that we're facing and that we got to get off of oil, as I said then and I continue to say every day, as quickly as we know how. What have we done about that? And I've taken plenty of heat for it, but we've built wind since I've been governor. We've expanded solar drastically in the state, more than any other state in America. In fact, of our job creation, the Solar Foundation rates Vermont now as the first this year. We have more solar jobs than any other state in the country per capita. We are building out, energy efficiency, heat pumps. We've got a very ambitious goal of being 90% renewable by 2050, and I'm bound and determined to make it. Now, I'm talking about climate change as a job creator, which it's been for Vermont, and I will continue to focus on it like a laser. Now, reasonable people can disagree about how we get off of that oil, and I know that you and I disagree, and I appreciate your expressing your point of view. Mine's a little different. If the Public Service Board determines that it's cost-effective for Vermonters, that it makes sense to run the pipeline on the western side of the state, my own view is that if you look what natural gas has done for Chittenden County and Franklin County in terms of the environment, not to mention the economy, but the environment, it has taken folks who are burning dirty oil in their heating systems and dirty oil in their businesses and moved them to a cleaner fossil fuel. I do see natural gas as a transition fuel to a cleaner, greener, brighter future for Vermont and the nation. So reasonable people can agree or disagree on that, but if we can move it down the western side of the state and move Vermonters to a more affordable, cheaper, less polluting energy source on our way to this transition to renewables, I think that's a good thing for Vermont to do. So we won't agree on everything, but I think we agree on the big picture, which is whether or not we disagree that moving to natural gas is better than burning dirty oil as a transition fuel. I bet we agree on all the other principles that I'm standing for on climate change. I'll continue to stand on them, and I'm looking forward to being in New York at the gathering of climate change leaders around America that's taking place shortly.
Today on the program, our guest is Governor Peter Shumlin. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Governor Peter Shumlin. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Your Republican opponent in this race this year, Scott Milne, has raised about $50,000. Libertarian candidate Dan Feliciano, I think, is somewhere around $25,000 at this point. You've got $1 million in the bank. It seems like your recent fundraising has slowed down a little bit. Is that in recognition that it might be inappropriate to spend vastly more money than either Milne or Feliciano on this race?
Well, I think my fundraising's on track. I'm going to spend what I need to spend to get my message out to Vermonters. I'm actually one of the candidates, the governors, who's crazy enough to support a two-year term. I love going out and asking Vermonters for their vote and explaining to them why I'm running and why I think it's important for the next 2 years. So the most, I spend most of my campaign time out talking to Vermonters. That's what I love to do. But I do understand that TV ads and all that stuff is a part of the process, and I got to raise the money to do that.
Dean Corin, who's the progressive candidate for lieutenant governor and also the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, has accused incumbent Republican lieutenant governor Phil Scott of taking big contributions from wealthy people and businesses. And Corin says those contributors get something tangible in return. Here's what he said.
It's just silly to think that wealthy people who didn't generally get wealthy by being stupid, or corporations that didn't get successful by being stupid, are going to invest their money in something that doesn't have a payoff. It's just foolish.
So according to the latest campaign finance reports, you've raised roughly 10 times the money that Phil Scott has raised this year. Do you think Dean Corn is right? Do the people who have contributed to your campaign expect something in return?
I actually think both Phil and Dean are right on this one. There's no question that the obscene amount of money that goes into politics in Washington, D.C., by corporations, we're not talking about $2,000 contributions or less, but we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands, is diverting democracy. It's obscene, it's wrong, and Citizens United makes it even worse. But I also agree with Phil. In Vermont, this is kind of a special place politically. You know, a $2,000 donation doesn't buy you access to anything. I'll bet you that Phil is like me. I usually don't know who gave me money. I'm too busy doing my job to sit there and worry about who gave me money and who didn't. If someone calls me or wants to talk to me or has a problem they want to solve, I don't go, hey, I got to go see who gave us money. You know, we just go to work for them. That's our job. That's what we're elected to do. So I think Vermont's democracy is different. I think that Dean has a good point on the national front, but I think in Vermont, there isn't kind of a pay-and-play system that you see in states and in a nation where they take these huge contributions from corporations.
We got this email from Bridget. Bridget writes us, this week, the Vermont Center for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing announced they'd be closing their doors and ceasing services to Vermonters throughout the state. This is a devastating blow to many families in Vermont who have benefited from their support. Have there been any discussions about how the state can help salvage these jobs and fill this gap in support of the more than 23,000 Vermonters who are deaf and hard of hearing?
You know, it's a real loss, and it breaks my heart that the Austin School is in the trouble that they're in. And it's been a long time coming. As I'm sure many know, I'm from Windham County. Austin's been a part of my life. I've had many friends that have worked there. I've had many friends that have gone there. And it's been an extraordinary asset and jewel for Vermont and for the hard of hearing. The problem for them is that with technology and other things, there's a real drop in the population of the number in the population of folks that need Austin, and people don't now use a rural residential model. They instead are mainstreamed into our schools and our communities. So it used to be, you know, when I was a young guy, that if you were hard of hearing, you went to Austin and the state paid. Now the model is to mainstream all Vermonters and have more diversity in our schools. So it's been very tough for them. It's been a long time coming. I don't think that there's anything that the state can do at this point to change the real facts, which is that their student the demand for Austin has dropped precipitously because of mainstreaming and because of technology.
Let's turn to Robert in Burlington. Hey, Robert, welcome to the program. Robert, are you there?
Hi.
Hey, Robert, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm on the air. I know. I was. I just wanted to ask the governor what his reasons were for dismissing Doug Racine and what his reasons were for using a lower office functionary to do it instead of having calling him into the office yourself and explaining to him the reasons. Usually when there's not malfeasance involved, the person who hires you is the person who fires you. If that's something you could explain, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the question. I'm not going to talk about the details of Doug's departure from state government. I am going to say this. Doug was leading one of the toughest agencies in state government. It's the biggest agency in state government, and it's dealing with our most vulnerable. He did a great job really focusing on the folks that are getting left behind in this economic recovery, and it's some of the folks, I should say, because the middle class, many of the middle class are there too, but it's the lower-income Vermonters. And no one did it with more passion and more dedication than Doug. So I'm incredibly grateful for his service. He did many, many great things. As I said at the time, I was ready for a different style of leadership.
Let me ask you about the economy. You talked about Vermont's unemployment rate, one of the lowest in the country. When you became governor in January of 2011, Vermont's unemployment rate was 6%. And today I think it's around 3.7%, something in that range. That looks pretty good. It gives the indication that Vermont economy is on the right track. But some other labor statistics paint a slightly different portrait of what's going on. When you took office, 338,000 people were employed in the state of Vermont. And according to information from the Vermont Department of Labor, there are exactly the same number of people employed in Vermont today as were employed in January of 2011. And it also shows that the number of people in Vermont's workforce is actually declined by 4%. So are those signs of a strong economy?
Listen, this is what I know. You can read these numbers a million different ways and come up with different charges. I know my opponents in this election are advocating the policy, the outline that you just made. But listen, this is what I know. When I came into office, I said I was going to focus on jobs like a laser, and that's what I've done. And we're getting results. There's no disputing the fact that we have 9,200 jobs created since I became governor. We also have people retiring. I understand that. But we're actually one of the few states that has more jobs than at the very peak of the economy in 2005. So, there are other states that have done this too, but a lot of states would love to have the numbers that we have where they're actually above the 2005 peak pre-recession numbers. So the obvious question is, we can bicker about the numbers. This is what matters. If you're a middle-class Vermonter and your wages have remained stagnant, these numbers mean nothing to you. They do nothing for you. If you're a low-income Vermonter, these numbers do nothing for you. So I would argue we're on the right track. We're creating jobs. We're creating economic opportunity. It's been a slow and frustrating recovery. The middle class is still getting kicked in the teeth. I still talk to too many Vermonters who work in one or two or three jobs, are frightened to death of the winter coming. They got to fill up their oil tank, keep clothes on the kids, food on the, and pay college debt. So my point is, we're not doing well enough. And none of these numbers mean a darn thing to you if you're a middle-class Vermonter and you're still getting kicked in the teeth, or a low-income Vermonter and you're still getting kicked in the teeth. And my point is, I'm running for another 2 years because I believe that we can continue to implement policies that are going to improve incomes, improve affordability, because we're willing to make the bold decisions that are making this state a stronger place and a better place to live.
Quick email from Rachel. I'd like to know what the governor thinks about our high property taxes, how he plans to deal with it. My town of Standard has the highest residential educational tax in the country. I apologize. We don't have a lot of time, but are you going to have, or do you have a system, a plan for property tax reform?
Well, let me just answer Rachel's question. Rachel, listen, there isn't a Vermonter who doesn't agree with you that property tax is a huge challenge, just like health care growing faster than our incomes. The answer, in my view, is to, and we've already begun this, I've got the best Secretary of Education I could ask for in Rebecca Holcomb. She is now on the road talking to communities like Standard, small rural communities, about how we can right-size the ship cooperatively, not with a heavy hand of Montpelier saying, you shall open this school and you shall close this school, but instead a partnership with local communities and my administration where we come in, we show you the data. We say, this is where you are now. Your student count's continuing to drop. This is what will happen to your property taxes in 5 years. This is what will happen in 7 years if you keep doing things the way you're doing them. How can we work collaboratively with you, have a local community conversation about ways to right-size the ship? Vermont has now 30,000 fewer students than we had a few years ago. We haven't changed administration. We haven't changed infrastructure. We've got to make some changes, and I believe it's got to come from the ground up, not the top down.
So that would be, you would oppose mandatory consolidation?
You know, I won't oppose any idea that works, but the answer is yes. I have always said that if you want to see a real mess, have Montpelier decide what's best for Standard and what's best for Mount Holly, because those two communities may have entirely different needs.
We'll certainly be following many of these issues during the gubernatorial campaign. Governor Peter Shumlin, many thanks for being on the program today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And we want everyone to know that later this month, VPR will host a governor's debate. And for that event, we ask your help. What questions do you want to hear the candidates weigh in on? Email vermontedition@vpr.net, or better yet, record your question on your smartphone and send us an MP3. Coming up next, I'll talk with VPR's Pete Hirschfeld about some of the dynamics in this year's campaign. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Well, earlier this week, Governor Shumlin officially kicked off his reelection campaign in Burlington. We now have just over 7 weeks before the November election. And how's this campaign race shaping up? We turn to VPR's Pete Hirschfeld to give us some answer. Hey, Pete.
Hey, Bob.
You were there in Burlington when the governor announced his reelection campaign on Tuesday. What's his general message?
I think you heard a little bit of it during that time you were talking with him, but Peter Shumlin wants Vermont to boldly go where no state has gone before. And the stump speech that he broke out last week is the latest version of this kind of guy that gets tough things done message that he's been using since his days as Senate president, really. He wants the state to conquer new frontiers, whether it's positioning the state as a leader in renewable energy or making Vermont the first state in the country with a single-payer healthcare system. You know, he also hit on some old familiar standbys, Tropical Storm Irene and the recovery that we saw there, education with a particular focus on pre-kindergarten and post-secondary. And while he certainly tried to glorify the state's economic situation, he's trying to make an effort not to sound tone deaf to people in this state that are really struggling financially right now. Vermont has the second lowest unemployment rate in the country. Peter Shumlin will not have too many appearances this fall where that fact does not go unmentioned. At the same time, he knows that that's because largely because the state's workforce is shrinking and that there are a lot of people who are struggling. He wants to sound optimistic about the economy while recognizing that there are people who aren't doing quite as well as the labor market statistics might indicate.
And it sounds like he is completely committed to single payer.
I think that's right. When you hear him talk about single payer now, it's almost like he's trying to convince us that he's still serious about it. I think that's largely because he's had 4 years to tell people how he'd raise the $2.2 billion in taxpayer money that will be needed to replace private premiums, and says he still can't give us really even a whiff of what direction he's headed in public financing wise until after the election. There are some interesting differences in the single payer message depending on what audience he's talking to. Sometimes he'll say very emphatically that if the public financing proposal isn't going to grow jobs, isn't going to be great for the economy as he thinks it is, he'll pull it back, call the dogs off, try something else. When he was talking to his crowd of raucous campaign supporters last week, he said we're moving toward a single-payer system and that he, quote, will not rest until it is done. So he'll continue to try to thread that needle, convincing his liberal base that he's going to stand by this promise without, you know, freaking out a business and medical provider community that is much, much more skeptical about this plan.
So in that reelection speech, did Shumlin have anything to say about his two opponents, his main party opponents? That would be Libertarian Dan Feliciano and Republican Scott Milne?
He certainly did. Now, all the problems going on in state government notwithstanding, Peter Shumlin is extraordinarily well positioned to win a third term and could probably skate through this campaign without really engaging his opponents. But he's not doing that. He went after them and he went after them hard. And he really is looking to kind of restore the grassroots enthusiasm that he enjoyed back in his inaugural run in 2010. And also probably to demonstrate to lawmakers in Montpelier that the public is still squarely behind his agenda. He said his opponent's health care plan can be summed up as, quote, good luck and fend for yourself. That's a characterization I'm sure they might quibble with. And he said that they, quote, live in a world of no. Shumlin is going to spend the next 8 weeks talking about all the stuff he wants to do. Scott Milne and Dan Feliciano are going to spend that same time talking about stuff they're going to try to stop him from doing. And I think he likes the way that narrative shapes up for him, talking in the affirmative about things is always more appealing than talking in the negative.
So what did they have to say about his reelection priorities?
Well, Dan Feliciano, who to date is running a more media-savvy campaign than Scott Millen for sure, is going after the Shulman on his key points. Single-payer, failures on the health insurance exchange. He's holding lots of press conferences, targeting his political punch as well. Scott Millen, meanwhile, has yet to really deliver a signature policy proposal. And his candidacy, honestly, is going to wither without one. Milne says later this month he'll unveil the specifics that everybody's been waiting for on hot-button issues ranging from education and property tax reform to how to fix the healthcare system. It's pretty clear what Scott Milne is running against, and that's the governor. But until he presents that plan, it's going to be tough to know exactly what he's running for.
Right now, it seems like people who strongly oppose Governor Shumlin are looking at Dan Feliciano as the candidate most likely to present their case. What do you think the ceiling is for him in this race?
You know, it's hard to say. Dan Feliciano has tapped into something real. There is a segment of the electorate out there whose ideological conscience is offended by the idea that government would assume the role that Peter Shumlin wants it to in their healthcare plans. And if you look at single-payer polls, the percentage of registered voters who feel that way is somewhere on the order of 24% to 26%. Will he be able to convince all of them to come over to his side? I think that depends in large part on the extent to which Scott Milne can engage the conservative base between now and November.
BPR's Pete Hirschfeld, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you, Bob.
In the news this week, a nonprofit group is educating patients and doctors about the law that allows doctors to prescribe a lethal dose of medication for terminally ill patients. Only two doctors have reported writing the prescriptions in the last year. Also this week, Lebanon College students struggled to find other classes after the private college announced that it was shutting down. Meanwhile, Vermonters are trying to wrap their heads around a new law that will ban handheld cell phone use while driving. A survey conducted by the Castleton Polling Institute found that a quarter of Vermont households don't subscribe to a broadband service. Burlington College students took advantage of locally grown food delivered to their campus, and the wife of the late Vermont Senator George Aiken died this week. Lola Aiken was 102. These are some of the voices in the news this week.
People we dealt with were just so honest and open and supportive of helping us through the particular procedure, but also just in general with the concept that our loved one was hastening the end of her life.
But I guess I never thought it would come to this, and I was reeling because I put a year and a half into taking classes there.
So the law now, as it is, it's a total hands-free. You have to have your phone in some type of cradle or have some type of Bluetooth device within your vehicle where you can communicate with basically just a one touch to activate and deactivate.
My daughters email each other all the time, and I thought, gee, I wish I could do that.
Thought it was a good way to get fresh vegetables every week and something that we don't have to worry about buying every week from the grocery store instead, and it's obviously local, organic.
I like to keep that brain of mine moving.
You can explore all of these stories and more at our website, vpr.net. That's Vermont Edition for today. Monday on the show, we'll learn how some hospitals in Vermont are preparing for a single-payer system. Listen for that discussion Monday at noon. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed this show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.